hearing, an overview of the Central City Plan District Code changes.
Rachel Hoy is here from BPS. She's very familiar with the code she's about to do an overview on. This code went into effect today. And I just did the memo just has a brief list of all the regulations that are current that were amended, and then some additional new regulations that you aren't as familiar with. So Rachel has a presentation, she'll go through it. I also brought a copy of the actual code language. Since it is in effect, we have copies available. So if you have any questions or follow-up questions, you can always take a look at this and I can pass it around. And with that, I'll hand it over to Rachel.
Welcome.
Thank you, Rachel Hoy with Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So I'm just going to start, go over some quickly general overview for you. The Central City, this is the boundaries of the Central City, and there are now 10 sub-districts. And River District has gone away, and it's being replaced by the Pearl sub-district and Old Town Chinatown sub-district. We've reduced the size of the downtown district. It is, you can see that is smaller with the West End is now its own sub-district, and then a combination of University and South Downtown. And the Central City boundary has expanded just a bit to the south on the east side. The Clinton Station area has now been included. Just a little bit about some of the zone changes. Not huge changes here, but primarily in the Central City, the red is CX, which is Central Commercial. And this, as you're, I'm sure, aware, allows flexibility for residential and commercial development. The proposed changes that we've made are in an effort to simplify the zoning pattern in the Central City, but at the same time add more flexibility around the Central City. So I'll just use the pointer here to highlight some of these hatched marks, show you areas of change. All of this was RX zoning, and it's now gone to CX. Same with this area here. We did retain some RX or residential zoning in this area. I will say some of the changes that we've made, we've tried to make the RX zoning more flexible as well to allow for more office and commercial on the ground floor. And in an effort to preserve some of the older non-residential buildings in these RX zones, for example, the YWCA, we have allowed these buildings in the future, they can be up to 100% in retail sales and service or office. And again, this is just to allow for more options for reuse and rehab of those older buildings. On the east side of the river, we've changed some zoning in the southern part of Central East Side to EX, employment zoning. Same along here. Some of these areas, this is no housing allowed. These areas were IG1 with a comp plan EX, so they are just going to a straight EX. Another change within the IG1, which is the area in gray, that I think is of interest to your commission, is that 100% of the gross building area of a historic landmark or contributing resource in a historic or conservation district in the IG1 may be in industrial office in the Central East Side. So again, we're just trying to find ways for some of these older buildings to provide some more options for reuse and rehabilitation. For changes to floor area ratio, the one thing I want to point out generally in the central city, we have now there are minimums. So for new development as well as for transferring of floor area, there are minimum FARs that will apply across the Central City, ranging from 1-to-1 to 3-to-1. This is exempt for industrial zones, of course, or open space zones. and for Portland Public Schools was a kind of a last minute change that was made at City Council. Few areas that we did increase FARs, there really are not that many here. The colors of blue, you'll see this aligns with transit mall station areas. This area here is around the River Place area, the post office site up here, and areas of the Pearl District where we did increase the FARs a bit. And one thing that I would point out that I want to highlight here that I know you're familiar with, but the floor area ratios did not increase in historic districts except for one block in New Chinatown, Japantown. It's block 33. The base FAR of that block is 6-1, so it'll stay at 6-1. That's what it has been. But in the future, if a project comes in, they can access a base of 9-1 for the full block if all floors above the ground floor on the western half of the block are in a residential use.
I thought that was only if it was affordable housing. No, it has to be. It's just residential, as long as it's residential.
If it's in a residential use, so the affordable housing piece is tied to if they access the bonus height.
Oh, height. Okay.
So there is, and I'll get to that, but there is also, there's a separate provision that ties it to that. Let's see. I think there are another thing of interest may be that along the South Park blocks, we have retained some provisions for properties with frontage along the South Park blocks that are zoned RX. There are no transferring to sites along that area. So this is a map we've used and has been really useful just to paint a picture of some of the height changes that have occurred in the central city. Some of the areas that, and I should just say, any height changes that we made in terms of increases in height, and those are the areas in gold, are tied to the bonus system. So everyone maintained a base height, and if there were any increases that were to be made, we then tied those to the use of the bonus system. And I'll get to that in just a moment. So some of these areas with increased height are along the transit mall, at bridgeheads, you'll see that some of these align with some of the areas where we also increased FARs, where we needed to kind of right-size the FARs with height increases. Decreases are some of these interesting shaped areas. These are view corridors, all of our historic districts. We have decreases in height, or we've removed the bonus height opportunity to have bonus height. And then there are areas in green where they're in green because they are areas where we're applying a height for the first time. These were industrial zoning, and so they didn't have a set height, and now we've actually set a height in those areas. So this is a snapshot of the historic districts in the central city. And generally, as I mentioned, in historic districts, access to bonus height has been removed. So that's why on the previous map you saw a decrease in height. And really, for the most part, what that means is these historic districts, for the most part, retained their base heights, and we took away their allowance for bonus height. Now on one particular block, so we have on block 33 in New Chinatown, Japantown, the western half of the block can get up to 200 feet of, in bonus height, but that's just with the use of the affordable housing bonus. That's the only bonus that they can use to access that. And a couple other things I just wanted to point out. In Irvington, there actually was a slight increase in the base height. from 50 feet to 75, but ultimately it was an overall decrease because we removed their ability to get bonus height. And then in the East Portland Grand Avenue in mid-district, the base heights were reduced to 160. And that was a discussion that we had within that Southeast Quadrant planning process. We felt that within that area, we were using the height of the existing historic Weatherly building as a point of reference to set that height.
Does the height allowance in Irvington apply to the entire neighborhood or just that area by Broadway?
It's that area within the central city.
Okay.
I don't know that I had, did I? So.
Got it. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
So for the new FAR bonus system, which Stacy said this code takes effect today, we have really streamlined what's available for bonusing in the central city. There's the affordable housing bonus, where you build affordable housing on site or you pay into affordable housing fund. And then we have a few specialized or specific to certain areas of town. There's a riverfront open space bonus, can only be used for properties along the riverfront and if they increase the setback from the river. And then there are three bonuses that we're retaining that existed under the old code for that are specific to South Waterfront. And in Central City, I would say that the new difference here with just a much smaller set of bonuses is that we've set a priority for the use of the bonuses. So if you are building residential and you trigger inclusionary housing, then you are going to be using the affordable housing bonus. You're going to be building affordable housing, and that is the first bonus that you can go to for that 3-to-1. Beyond 3-to-1, you have the choice of going to the historic resource transfer, or you can go to another transfer that I'll describe here in just a moment. So the new transfer system, just a few quick things about it, but I'm going to spend a little more time talking about the historic resource transfer. Transfers are, you have to keep in mind that, as I mentioned, there are new minimum FAR requirements. So a sending site must retain the minimum FAR, a minimum FAR on site. And we've also are allowing the open space zone is now an eligible zone to send FAR. They cannot receive FAR, but they can now be sending sites for FAR. There are two new transfers. We have, one new and one is the historic resource transfer that we've had, but we've changed it quite a bit and it's expanded across the central city. So the historic resource transfer is a priority. So for example, if you are not building residential, or you don't trigger the inclusionary housing program, then you can use the historic resource transfer right away if you need more FAR. And there is still the option to pay into the Affordable Housing Fund, but we didn't want to have, if you're not going to trigger inclusionary housing, we wanted to give a project the choice that they could choose between the Affordable Housing Fund or they could transfer from a historic resource. The other after 3-to-1, and this is for up to 3-to-1. So 3-to-1 from a historic, transferring from a historic resource, or 3-to-1 paying into the Affordable Housing Fund. And after that point, if a project still is in need of additional FAR, there's a transfer within a floor area sector. And those sectors align with transportation modeling areas that we worked on with Department of Transportation. But they tend to, like the downtown area, similar to the sub-district map that I showed you. While we have 10 sub-districts, there are 10 transfer areas, and the downtown is actually the largest transfer area that you can use and transfer FAR to use that transfer within a sector. So the historic resource transfer, a couple big things that I want to point out. landmarks and contributing resources are eligible to use this. So this is a change that the contributing resources were not eligible with the previous historic resource transfer. Historic resources must be seismically upgraded, or if the building's not seismically upgraded, you can sign an agreement with the city to complete upgrades. And the signing of that agreement then makes you eligible to transfer your FAR. But you've now signed an agreement with the city that you will upgrade that building seismically within 10 years. And it's very similar to, we have a phased seismic agreement now at the city that BDS implements. So we've tweaked it a little bit for the sale of FAR, but it still is, you know, they're required to submit plans, it's monitored, there are penalties for not upgrading. So the hope is that, I would also point out, if a building's not seismically upgraded and they decide to enter into an agreement, we're also providing an additional 3-to-1 to those properties in hopes that that additional FAR, it's more funding, it'll help support the payment of those upgrades. The receiving sites can be anywhere in the central city except for South Waterfront. So that's how we've also expanded the area. And owners of the sending and receiving sites must complete a covenant documenting the floor area on each site. And the covenant for the sending site must state that the owner will not demolish or relocate the historic resource unless the city approves that through a demolition review process. We've expanded the shadow study requirement across the central city. The shadow study has is applied on the wet to properties west and south of open spaces and parks. And this would include, this is actually a picture here of a shadow analysis we did for the Lansu Garden. And there are also, with the shadow study, we've increased the number of days and the times per day that the shadow analysis, what the shadow analysis needs to show. So basically at spring and fall equinox and summer and winter solstice, those are the days. And then there's at noon and 3 p.m. that that needs to be conducted.
And what time is this? Do you know what time this drawing is?
I knew you were going to ask me that. And I didn't write it down.
Oh, okay.
I believe that this is March. And I think this was the 3 p.m. On March 21st. I can double check that for you, but yeah.
So what actually happens to, you know, with the results of the shadow study? Is it just an act of disclosure, or?
Well, I'm going to look to staff too, but it factors in. It's a standard, so it mm-hmm. becomes part of the review process. Mm-hmm.
As a standard, if it doesn't meet the specifics of the standard, then an adjustment would be needed, or a modification, whatever language is stated in the code.
Okay.
There's other cases throughout the code where it's used as criteria. That's a little more flexible, but in this instance, it's specifically a standard, and if it's not met explicitly, it has to be modified.
Okay, thanks.
But we did, in Central City 2035, that was a discussion at council of if they should consider adjustments being prohibited, but they decided against that. So at this point, it is still modifiable.
But aren't you making an adjustment or modification because of impact on somebody else's property? I don't understand how that works. We can get into this more, but you know, maybe you should finish first.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just. Okay, sorry. Go on, Rachel. We'll come back to that.
Okay. Just to few quick things I want to add related to street and development character. We've made a number of changes to improve the pedestrian experience across the central city. In this area, you know, approximately 40% of the central city's land area is in streets. So we've made quite a few changes to required building lines. For example, along the park blocks, there's now a required 12-foot setback along both sides of the park blocks for new development. We've increased ground floor windows. We've actually mapped an area in the downtown retail core where 60% ground floor window coverage is required. We've increased the base is 40% now across the entire central city. We've modified our ground floor active use standards. In many cases, this really has to do with requiring taller, deeper first floors and limitations on ground floor residential uses on many streets in the downtown core. And that also is now a mapped thing where ground floor residential is prohibited in a number of areas. We have a new provision for allowing small retail spaces in the open space zone. And we also have done, there are extensions to sidewalks and gathering areas through the required building lines, increasing the that extension of the sidewalk. And in other areas, we're allowing for landscaping. So that is also a new mapped element that if you're not extending the extension, it's not an extension of the sidewalk, there's a provision allowing for increased trees and landscaping in these areas. And we've also prohibited new drive-throughs in the entire central city.
Wasn't that already prohibited?
No. There were some areas that it was, but not across the entire central city.
Does that apply to the coffee stands that you see in lots all over town?
If it's, I mean, in terms of how we, no, if it's
I'm
a
temp,
yeah, if it's a temporary, I mean, some of those are, I mean, I guess if they're permitted and temporary, that's something that I would leave to BDS to determine. But if it is actually, there's a new curb cut for a drive-through and they've got, you know, that would not be allowed in the central city in the future in any location. Just a few new green building provisions that I want to make you aware of. Bird-safe glazing. So this would apply to major remodels and new development, and this would apply to all non-contributing buildings in historic districts. And if the standard is triggered, and that applies to buildings with more than 30% of glazing, and that's measured per facade. So if one side of a building has 29% glazing, they don't need to meet this. But as soon as you hit 30% glazing or more per facade, then you've triggered this requirement. And it's basically a new requirement for etching, or there's UV coatings that can be applied in the first 60 feet of it measured from the sidewalk, 60 feet up. And again, this is to prevent bird strikes. The next provision is eco-roofs. The new eco-roof requirement, it's 100% coverage for buildings 25,000 square feet or greater. Now there is allowed up to 40% of that may be in, for example, mechanical equipment or other necessary elements, evacuation, stairwell, and walkways, and other desirable elements such as patios. But the rest of it then must be in eco-roof. The low carbon building requirement is a requirement for new buildings over 50,000 square feet or buildings that expand by at least 50,000 square feet. So the provision is just for registration with a program. There are four that BPS has chosen at this time, and BPS will actually provide a letter to BDS once the registration is complete. It's due at the time of permit that the new development has registered with one of these programs. At this time, it's not full certification with one of these green building programs, but the registration, full certification in many cases is more stringent than what the current building code allows, so we couldn't allow for full certification, but registration at this time, it's part of an ongoing effort with our green building team at BPS to kind of continue the momentum or trend that we have of most buildings in the central city do tend to register and move forward with some sort of certification program. This is a new tool I just wanted to point out quickly in the central city. We have a new master plan tool. This is important for key redevelopment opportunities in the central city. There's a set here that are mapped that are required sites. This is also a voluntary tool if the site is 160,000 square feet or larger. And I want to make you aware of this because you may see this come before you. There may be sites that, for example, there's been a pre-app for Centennial Mills, and they're interested in the master plan tool. Also, any site with existing buildings, so if any of these sites or others that choose to do this voluntarily, you have to show existing buildings that will be preserved on your plans. I think unless you have questions there, I'll probably move on because I want to leave some time for questions. And then this is my last slide. Just finally, we have future work plan. We have policies and actions that I wanted to make you aware of. The first two policies there are new and they're primarily guiding policies for future historic preservation. They'll help guide our work and planning efforts and any new zoning code that we create. And then I know that you're aware that below there are two actions and work that's currently underway. Brandon is working on that first bullet there and has, I believe, either brought that before you or will be talking with you as he wraps up that work in the next few months. And then the update to the Central City Fundamental Design Guidelines, that's work that we're doing now, but really you probably will not have a briefing from us until maybe the earliest towards the end of this year. We'll really be getting more into the work and finalizing that in 2019. And I'll stop there. Are there any questions?
Rachel, these policies that you listed here, are these part of the comp plan? Where do these fit in?
These are part of the Central City Plan. So, yeah.
They realized they had their own policies. Is that new?
Well, the Central City Plan is part of we're the first amendment to the comprehensive plan.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah. And so when the comp plan was updated, we had some broad policies that were there, but knowing that we were going through a process to create new policies specific to the Central City.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think some of these policies, to Rachel's point, are sort of mirror what was added to the new comp plan. They seem to fit nicely in with some of the new policies that were adopted as part of the 2035 plan.
Yeah.
I also didn't realize that they had their own policies in the central city as well. So now that we have 10 of them, we don't call them quadrants anymore, right?
Right. They're sub-districts within the central city. It's a central city plan district, and we have 10 individual sub-districts.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Have you guys looked at the monetary value of the FAR transfer and what that actually amounts to in potential dollars for some of these historic buildings? Or what is the value of floor area?
We know, so that's not something that happens on the open market. It does not have to be disclosed as part of the covenants that we keep covenants and BDS keeps them in our track system, but it tracks the FAR movement. We know anecdotally, working with different people, that in the past, FARs traded anywhere from $5 to $15 a square foot. Depends on where you're located. It could be higher, too, again, depending on where the property's located. By limiting the number of transfers, we had 6 transfers. Now we're down to 2, and the historic resource transfer is the number one priority. And we've equalized the, I feel, the importance of that transfer with affordable housing, especially if you don't trigger inclusionary housing. If you're not building a residential development, you have a choice of where you can get your FAR. So we're hoping that that's used. We also understand that by applying the need for the building to be seismically upgraded, that's expensive. But it's also part of our desire to preserve the building.
It just hopefully is an incentive for current buildings that aren't on the register to potentially look at that as an avenue, as an incentive to put more buildings on the inventory. So,
and that was also part of our reason for, again, helping to pay for seismic upgrades and maybe an encouragement for more buildings to consider it by providing an additional 3-to-1 FAR that they can sell.
What is the definition of historic resource, though, that would be able to be the sending site? Is it?
It's a historic landmark or conservation landmark, contributing resources in historic districts.
On a national level, not local? Or is it local, too?
It's state and federal. So the state, local.
Both local and national register.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Have you received a lot of inquiries from folks about?
We've received, surprisingly, quite a few in the last couple of weeks, but mostly the questions have been the getting their plans in or meeting with plans examiners saying, we want to transfer from this building. We need to know if they already meet the seismic requirements that are detailed in the code. So there's a certain, the Oregon Structural Specialty Code that applies. It's a pretty high bar, but if they meet it, then they're eligible to transfer and they get an additional 3-to-1. They don't have to enter into this seismic agreement. So that's been, yes, more the line of questioning we've received.
And aren't seismic requirements kind of by the building's use? So for instance, could someone change the use later and not necessarily trigger the higher seismic requirement? I mean, I guess that's just a theoretical question, but.
The change of use, if it was a more stringent use, would actually trigger it. I don't know, going the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Right. I could see how you've changed your use, you're going to come in. You'd have to review that change of use with the city.
One more question, if I could. So does PSU, is there a requirement for them to have a master plan in the?
They're not one of the required sites. Certainly there's nothing preventing them if they met the voluntary, that they could enter into one, but there's not a requirement.
Aren't they part of the institutional and campus zoning project too? No?
PSU is not.
It is not part of that. And I'm sorry, I can't remember where we landed on transfers to. Can these transfers be made into historic districts?
Yes. So thank you for bringing that up. So within a historic district, well, we've set heights across the central city. And so historic districts or not, across the entire central city, the amount of FAR that you have on your site for your project, you can transfer as much as and bonus as much as you'd like, but you're bound by, that's your limit, whatever your height is on your height, on the height map.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.